It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 9th, 2022. This week we speak with Noah Banyan. Noah is the Director of Federal Policy for People for Bikes, and she's here to help us unpack the America's Recreation Act of 2022. This is a bipartisan piece of legislation that was introduced into the Senate in November of last year, and the bill provides for additional recreation opportunities and facilities for greater access to federal public lands. In it, there are two bills that pertain specifically to bicycling, one that helps to open up and connect long trails, and the second that frees up some of the time and hassle it takes to get permits for ride, race, and tour directors who want to use state and federal lands. Then we're going to catch up with the Ohio bike lawyer, Steve Magus. While I intended to just sort out crash statistics for Ohio, hoping to be able to extrapolate them across the country, Steve and I actually talk about a lot more than that, diving into some of the reasons the fatalities, which were high in the 70s, began to decline until the early 2000s, have now begun to climb upward again. Steve thinks there might be a master's thesis in there somewhere. So let's begin in Washington, D.C. with Noah Banyan from People for Bikes. Hi, Noah. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's good to see you. Well, it's good to talk with you. Of course, nobody else will see you. How are you?
Thanks, Diane. I'm doing well.
You're in D.C.?
I am. I'm home in D.C.
And it is beautiful there right now.
It has been, yeah. I think we're about to get some rain all weekend, but it's been a really nice week.
That's good. Yeah. We're going to get that rain too. How nice for us. Like we need more rain because it's spring. So I really want to talk to you about this America's Outdoor Recreation Act of 2022. It was introduced. It was bipartisan. Tell us what it is. And I know that there is a request from People for Bikes that we contact our legislators. So I want to know why we need to do that if it's bipartisan.
Totally. No, that's a really great political question there, Diane. But so the America's Outdoor Recreation Act of 2022 is really a lot of bills put together. So we're looking at it as this large recreation package. So it includes a lot of priorities that People for Bikes has been pushing in Congress, along with many of our partners in bike advocacy. There's the BOLT Act, which is the biking on long distance trails. I think this is one of the most exciting for bike advocates and enthusiasts. This bill it doesn't actually have that much money involved, but what it would do is bring together land management agencies at the federal level. So DOI, including Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, and the Forest Service under the Department of Agriculture, to identify, like research and identify no less than 10 long distance biking trails. And by long distance, they mean more than 80 miles in length. And so that's either existing trails or potential future trails or trails that require critical connections to become long distance. And what this is really looking at is, how do we identify where to send federal and state resources of trail development for the next 10 big, great ideas for biking? The real scenic, tourism-inducing trails and connectors that bring people into more rural communities, bring tourism dollars, but also give folks just like truly that unique bike packing, mountain biking experience out in the woods somewhere or in the desert or wherever.
So I have a question about, you said existing or potential or connecting trails. Are there specific trails that have already been targeted in this bill? I mean, or do you know which trails are going to be targeted?
I don't know right now where exactly this will be targeted. I think that it's really up to local advocates and trail organizations to think about what this resource could mean for their big plans for trail development. I know this concept is really modeled off of trails like the Arizona Trail, or you know, you could think of the CNO Canal that connects, you know, that's a long one, connecting DC to Pittsburgh. So those, you know, really long in distance for sure, but also scenic, potentially historic, storytelling kinds of trails that offer really unique experiences biking.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Noah Banyan at People for Bikes. She's in DC. She's the federal policy director. You mentioned biking on long distance trails as one piece of the package, right, for this right of way or this new recreation act. Mm-hmm. What is another one of the pieces?
Yeah, the other one I think that we're most excited about among many in the larger package is called the SOAR Act, and that's a Simplifying Outdoor Access to Recreation Act. And this one might not be as, you know, easily as exciting as the Bolt Act for your standard bike advocate, but this one's really important for biking as recreation on public lands. For our, you know, treasured bike guides and outfitters who lead bike trips and tours across, you know, multi-day trips across multiple different kinds of lands, from forest land to parkland, BLM land, the headache that they suffer in planning those trips and getting permits to take you out on those incredible multi-day bike rides and tours can really be limiting and derail their plans and derail their business too. And so what the SOAR Act seeks to do is to streamline the federal recreation permitting process to make it easier so that a guide or an outfitter doesn't really have to go through like a quite literal paperwork process for each type of land that they're trying to go on, for every type of activity that they're bringing. The, you know, something we're really excited about within SOAR is the potential to include e-bikes on some of the bike trips. And that's been a limiting factor in some cases, and that you need a separate permit for e-bikes where you are allowed to access that trail and that land jurisdiction with e-bikes. What we're mostly excited about is the potential. This would require some clarification from the Department of Interior if and when the bill is passed, but the potential for bike trips that include qualifying e-bikes and analog bicycles to travel together on the same permit, ideally.
Having been a ride director for many, many years and knowing the permitting process and how tedious and difficult and onerous it sometimes is, where would the central organization, how would this, or do you know how this would work, this recreational biking? Like, so if we wanted to go from the towpath, which is the Ohio and Erie Canal towpath, and then hop on over to whatever the next trail is, you know, I'll make one up, the Eshtabula Greenway, which they do not connect at this point, but they might at some point, then instead of having to deal with the County of Eshtabula and the Cuyahoga National Park, how would they get those permits? Where would that central place be?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I'm not honestly sure of the specifics yet. I think a lot of how this will be structured is determined by the land management agencies coming together after the bill is passed. So Congress has to say, land managing agencies do this, and then they have to figure out the best way to do it, is my understanding. Though I'm sure upon further review of the bill, I might find some more details I missed specific to answering that question. But I understand that there will have to be some design that goes into this post passage.
Okay, we've got two pieces of this Recreation Act. Is there another big piece we should talk about? And I mean, we're going to direct people to a place where they can actually look at it, I think. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to ask for the little call to action, of course.
Yeah. So these are the two really big ones for biking opportunities. There are certainly others in there. You know, there's everything from making it easier to get filming permits on National Park Service lands, because that can be kind of difficult too, to just making the outdoors generally more equitable and accessible for all Americans. The overall purpose of this package is, I think, intent is to really meet this current demand for recreation across the United States, safe, accessible, close to home opportunities to get outside, whether that's by bike or by foot or by water too. There's, you know, I know the kayakers and canoers and everyone was really excited about this bill. So there's a lot of good stuff in there. I would really highlight Bolt and Soar as the biggest opportunities for biking specifically. But this overall package is just, I think, notable in that it's the first package put together that's really just focused on recreation and the federal government's role in that. And like you said before, it's bipartisan, which gives it a lot of foundation to keep moving.
Will this be under the Department of Transportation?
No, it's mainly focused on, I think, bringing together land management agencies under the Department of Interior. So Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, National Fish and Wildlife Service, but also, you know, bringing in the Forest Service, which is under the Department of Agriculture. I think there are some instances where the Department of Defense is involved and that they own the Army Corps of Engineers. So there's a lot of federal land management jurisdictions that are I think, referenced within the bill, and will have work to do after it's passed. I think Department of Transportation is in there in some cases where we're talking about roadways and connections, but mainly focused on the broader land management jurisdictions.
Let's get to when it's going to be, it's introduced already, but when it might come up for a vote and what it is that might kill it. I mean, is there anything that, is anybody saying, I don't want this?
I don't think so. So in the markup in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee on Tuesday, I mean, this moved by voice vote. This was, you know, it's bipartisan leadership of the committee on both sides of the aisle are really working together to move this forward. I think the biggest enemy, as with most policies for something like this, is just time, not enemy, but barrier, obstacle. You know, we're early May, summer is coming, August recess, and of course the midterm elections in November, you know, are things to really watch out for. We know that the legislative season just starts to dwindle very quickly as the weather warms up before an election. And so it's just finding time on the agenda in the Senate, making sure that the House is on board with the provisions. You know, they might want to introduce a similar version, but not the exact same, so that there's a lot of negotiation that could be required to merge the two bills. But I think it's very likely that this bill moves forward in a way, in a very similar way to what it looks like having passed this one committee in the Senate. But it is just a matter of timing and finding the agenda space to move it forward.
So what is it that listeners can do to say, yeah, get this moving, we want this to happen?
Right. No, this is the best part. So People for Bikes has a really easy tool that I'm sure you'll share out for folks to tell their senators, ask their senators to support this overall package. It will also send a thank you letter to your senator if they sit on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee in the Senate to show that you really support their work to have moved this forward so far. So ideally, building support across the Senate for this large package is really important right now. The more that folks are talking about it in the Senate, the more likely it is to build up to leadership and get that floor time and airspace. So that's our biggest ask right now, is to focus on your senators and make sure that they support this bipartisan package.
And you can go to peopleforbikes.org, and there is a great big square. Actually, it's a rectangle you can actually click on, and it will take you to the page that will allow you to do this. Well, Noah, it's always good to catch up with you. One real quick thing, you got an e-bike.
I do have an e-bike. Yes, I got one last year. So I live in DC. I have the great fortune of living in a city that has really great bike infrastructure. I also have an elevator in my apartment building, which has been helpful. It would be really heavy to carry upstairs. So I feel for folks who might live in a walk-up and not have that opportunity. But yeah, I use my e-bike for absolutely everything. I've managed to live in DC for almost 8 years without a car. And I don't know how I did that without an e-bike, honestly, now that I have one. I use it for grocery shopping, getting to meetings, to see friends, go out to dinner. I use it every day. It's the absolute best way to get around Washington, DC, and I think most cities now too.
What a great plug. E-Bike World would love to hear that. Well, no, it's always good to catch up. Thank you so much. We will put out all this information on outspokencyclist.com. And I hope you have a wonderful summer of riding.
Thank you, Diane. You too. Appreciate the conversation. Bye.
Noah Banyan is the Director of Federal Policy for People for Bikes. If you want to know more about the Outdoor Recreation Act and contact your officials, you can log on to peopleforbikes.org. There is also a link to the information on our website, outspokencyclist.com. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll speak with the Ohio bike lawyer, Steve Magus. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. In 2020, 21 people were killed on our roadways while riding their bikes. In 2021, it was even more devastating when that total rose to 28. Attorney Steve Magus has been tracking statistics on fatalities as well as noting other pertinent facts in Ohio and Kentucky for many years. In our conversation, Steve gives us some very important and detailed information about what is and isn't pertinent when it comes to being involved in a crash, in addition to some observations about how and why things seem to be so much worse these days. Hello, Steve. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's nice to see you. It's nice to talk with you. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be back. I don't know that we've Zoomed before, but I know we've talked before, so this is good.
We have not Zoomed before, and nobody will see this Zoom besides you and me, but that's okay.
Oh, okay.
It adds a quality to the conversation.
Oh, I definitely think so.
I always hate to talk with you about, I mean, I love to talk with you, but I hate the topic sometimes. And it's a difficult topic to talk about. And because I do a lot of shows on urban transportation and on safety and everything else, I thought we'd focus on Ohio because that's who you are, the Ohio bike lawyer. And before we get to the numbers, the statistics, which we will get to, I'm wondering if you see a trend around the country. I know what our trend is in here in Ohio, and it isn't good. Any places, is it good or is it just dismal everywhere?
Well, I'll tell you, I look back to the 70s when I started riding bikes. And in the 70s, it turns out those were the worst years for cycling on the road. Now, it's weird, not weird, it's different then than it is now in that 1,003 cyclists were killed in 1975. That's the worst year that we've had. And the statistic breakdown is that about two-thirds of those were kids. And most of those were kind of kids darting into traffic. So kids were riding bikes. They were getting into front of cars. Cars were hitting kids behind. The adults who were being killed were the small part of that. And then as you track the numbers, the kids are up here, the adults are down here, and they start moving together. And there's a point in the 80s, I think, where they crisscross. And then the adults take the majority of the fatalities and the kids go down. And today it's about 90%+ adults, mostly adult men, although the women's segment is sort of growing, but still very small. And the children are down to less than 10%, and probably significantly less than that. So I think there's probably a whole story there to be written about how we grew up, and people my age who grew up riding bikes, we kept riding because this era of fitness kind of came about in the 70s and 80s, and triathlons came about, and guys who were in their 30s suddenly found it cool to ride bikes when before guys in their 30s got cars and drove around. And so there's a whole sort of societal change that took over. But statistically, the numbers were the worst in the 70s. They dropped significantly for the decade of the 80s. They dropped significantly in the 90s. From 2000 to about 2007 or 8, they kept dropping. And we went from 1,900 fatalities in the 70s to 600s. The numbers are in the 600s in the 90s and early 2000s. And then there's a switch. And it comes in around 2008, 2009, and all of a sudden the numbers start climbing again. And they've the trend nationally and the trend locally and the trend regionally has been exactly that. Numbers drop. And then they turn the corner around 2007, 8, 9, and they've been going up in the past decade.
What caused that change?
Well, I think there's a master's thesis ready to be written there. To me, when I look at two data points, it sort of makes sense. One, the iPhone came out around 2007. And then a year or two after that, it enhanced its ability to grab the internet that's flying around and bring it into your car. And two, Facebook came about around 2007, 2008, it became exploded in popularity. And if you look at a chart of Facebook and you look at a chart of iPhone, the graph starts about this big. And then within a few years, it's this, you know, it goes into the from the millions to the hundreds of millions to the billions of users, and iPhones start little and they just expand. And all of a sudden, people are driving around in these two-ton bowling balls with these devices. Hey, you can take a picture. Look at me. I'm driving and post it to 10 different media sites, or you can search for the restaurant or get whatever you want to do. And it's right there in your hand. All you have to do is look at it. So I think that there's got to be some connection between that and distraction. And the people whose numbers are going up are the people who are the most vulnerable. So pedestrian deaths are climbing and cyclist deaths are climbing, but the deaths of people inside the cars is not. So you know, you can't go as fast when you're looking at your phone, maybe, and so you're distracted, but you can run over people that, you know, somebody in a car might get your attention, even if you're on your phone, but somebody on a bike or somebody on the sidewalk, as you slide over into the sidewalk or run through the crosswalk may not. I haven't studied that. Those data points just jump out at me as something that somebody ought to be looking at seriously at a national and federal level.
Let me reintroduce you, and we're going to move on to current statistics. Sure. We're speaking with Steve Magus. He is the Ohio bike lawyer. If you want more information about what Steve does, and he's got some interesting things on his website and some of the things that he does, we'll get to that a little bit later. So let's talk about some of the statistics from the last couple of years. You are one of the people, the only person I know, who actually takes a look at all of the statistics of fatalities and injuries in Ohio. And I think we can extrapolate from Ohio and probably see all across the country, but how many fatalities occurred in Ohio in 2020 and then 2021? Bicycle.
Right. So bicycle fatalities, we had 21 in 2020, which is surprising, which we can talk about. And then in 2021, we had the worst year in Ohio we've ever had. We had 28 cyclists who were killed. Historically, we've averaged 16 or 17 for a long time. 2020 was weird because nobody was driving. Nobody was going anywhere.
Allegedly.
Car use was way down because we're in the COVID. Yeah, well, no, people that actually study that and count the miles and come up with all of that, the use of cars was way down, the mileage was way down. One thing the state troopers tell us is they wrote more 100-mile-an-hour tickets in 2020 than in any year they've ever had. So speeds are up, and there's, you know, traffic congestion is down, so people are driving faster, the people that are actually driving. You know, that probably plays a role again in the fact that deaths in Ohio, I don't think, went down. We average about 1,000 people killed in cars every year. Of those, 16 or 17 are cyclists and 100 plus are pedestrians. Those cyclist and pedestrian deaths are up. You know, despite the fact that nobody's driving, we had 21 people killed in Ohio in 2020. And that was a big number. And then last year was just shocking to me that we had 28 cyclists killed in Ohio. So those are two bad years in a row.
Yeah, no kidding. Is there an area of the state that is more densely, you know, showing fatalities than other areas? I mean, there is a map and we'll talk about that eventually too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's always more crashes and more risk in bigger cities because there's more traffic and we're seeing more and more urban riding. Every year there, when you overlay the maps and you look at where things happen, there's always clusters and Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toledo, Dayton, you know, the bigger cities in Ohio tend to have the most crashes. Fatalities used to be more rural. You know, you'd get hit on a 55 mile an hour two-lane country road, you were at more risk than at downtown Cleveland, where traffic, you know, stop and go, and it's, you know, only 20 or 30 miles an hour, and bikes are keeping up with a lot of traffic. Columbus was always sort of the outlier in the big cities. There was always more happening in Columbus. And I, you know, just geographically, Columbus to me is like one giant flat, you know, bike path, because there's not a hill from the top of 270 to the bottom of 270. But so Columbus always had three or four fatalities. Then there's usually a couple in Cleveland, a couple in Cincinnati, and then the rest of them were kind of dotted around different cities and then more in the rural areas. We are seeing more urban fatalities, I don't think a statistically significant number when you look year to year. See, in the next 5 years, if these numbers stay high, you know, that's going to kind of change how we view Ohio a little bit, because Ohio's always been way below the national numbers in terms of fatalities per population. So, you know, Ohio's the seventh largest state. And you would picture, if you're thinking, you know, just statistically, okay, states with more people, they're going to have more crashes because there's more people driving, there's more people riding. But Ohio was way down below the midline of that. So we were one of the safer states historically, the last 10 or 15, 20 years since I've been studying this. Ohio was a safer state than many others because we have a lot of people, but not that many crashes and not that many fatalities. And we have a lot of bike riders and a lot of cycling activity. So it's not like we're a state where it snows year round and nobody rides a bike. We have hundreds of clubs, millions of people ride bikes in Ohio each year. A fewer crashes and a relatively small number typically are injured and killed.
Right. Well, if you compare it to places like Florida, especially where the statistics are just horrific. So is there anything about the statistics that give us any indication of how and why they are occurring? I mean, we talked about speed and we talked about congestion and we talked about that kind of things. Is there anything else that you see? I mean, I'm seeing angrier people on the road. I mean, is that something you're also experiencing?
I would say anecdotally, we are seeing an uptick in the intentional activity that goes on. People yelling, people screaming, complaints, people being run off the road or having something thrown at them or having these intimidating encounters with vehicles. I think anecdotally we're seeing that. That doesn't show up in the fatal crashes very often, and it doesn't show up in police reports, because often these encounters occur, somebody gets ticked off about it, but you call the police and they go, did he hurt you? Did you fall? Did you crash? Did something happen? No. Okay. Well, then, you know, we try to tell people to report those, because the next time it happens, your report might help the police understand, hey, this wasn't accidental. This guy's got a real problem. And I say this guy because it's usually men in trucks or men in fast cars that are ticked off at cyclists. And we see these encounters occur. You know, again, the typical person driving is a male, and he's yelling or screaming at a bike rider because they're in the way, and they are using some intimidating tactics with the vehicle to try to get them off the road. I've had a couple of cases in the last few years, one in particular in which a guy was angry, was passing a husband and wife. You know, the facts depend on who you talk to, but our client said it was a narrow two-lane road. The truck didn't get all the way over. It's a big pickup truck. He close past husband first, screaming, cussing out the window at him, goes past the wife, close on the elbow, screaming at her. And she gives the guy the one finger salute. And that causes him to then pull off the road to the right, get out of the truck. And he's coming at the wife as she's approaching, yelling at her. And as the husband tries to sneak by, he turns around and he body slams the husband into the pickup truck. And he's arrested. He's charged with serious, you know, felony, F2, goes to trial on that felony. And after a day of testimony, he decides to plead to a lower felony of an F4, which is still a felony of conviction, still a crime of violence. He had to give up all his weapons because you're not allowed to your guns when you're a convicted felon in a crime of violence. And so we filed a lawsuit against him. And the big issue in that case was, can we keep the insurance company in play to pay for my client's damages? Because he had $100,000 in medical bills and had a very serious elbow fracture that required surgery. And we were able to, through some legal motions, keep his insurance company in the game. Had we not done that, we would have been looking at this person individually to pay the damages, which right. could have been, you know, significant had we gone to trial. So,
right.
So that worked out in that way. But that's become, I've heard those stories a little more, not necessarily get out of the truck and beat somebody up, but use a vehicle as a tool to try to intimidate riders. And that happens, you know, if you've been riding many years as have I, that happened, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. We just seem to be seeing more of it now. And with the magic of people riding with cameras, you know, we're actually be able to record some more of that and you know, see it. If you what is it, Cyclic, CYCLIQ, is a brand of
camera. It's Cycle IQ.
Yeah. Okay, Cycle IQ. Yeah. That they have a very nice website where you can upload videos and they'll put them out. And, you know, there's 25, 30 videos a month that they have where people have these just crazy encounters that are recorded on their cameras. And, you know, cameras are a game changer for riders and for us who are handling these kind of cases. So that was a long answer to your, I don't even remember what the question was.
No, that's good. We're talking with Steve Magus. He's the Ohio bike lawyer. And I always go to him to know statistically what's going on because he really keeps good track of that. And we'll get back to some of those numbers. Maybe, I don't know. They're so scary. I don't even know if I want to do that. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and my guest is Ohio bike lawyer Steve Magus. So let me ask about some of the legal things that are going on in Ohio and maybe elsewhere. Are there any laws or is there any legislation that's being introduced that will help to either mitigate some of these problems, reduce crashes? I mean, we'll get to the infrastructure part because that's a big part of it as to whether or not we're going to have better and more protected bike lanes. But is there any legislation that is saying, listen, if you do this, we're going to put you away? I mean, it's hard to convict these people.
No, and that's the problem. There isn't any, unfortunately. The way the laws are set up now, people who do things intentionally, you know, with purpose, get punished pretty severely. People who do things carelessly but end up hurting people get less severely. So if you are fiddling with the radio dial and you accidentally run over a cyclist or a pedestrian and kill them, that's a misdemeanor. That's a first degree misdemeanor, maybe if you're charged at all. And the maximum penalty there is 180 days. There's a big disconnect between the result of your negligence and the negligent act that you do. Several years ago, I was part of a group, it's called the Right of Way Coalition. And we had a group of bicycling groups that partnered with the AMA, the motorcycle group that's headquartered near Columbus. And we put the package together to try to get a law changed that would not necessarily mandate an increased penalty, but give a judge an option in a case where there's a rear ender or there's a relatively minor traffic offense that ends up resulting with somebody being maimed or somebody being killed. you know, that's a payout traffic ticket. Here's a, you know, pay 125 at the clerk's office, see you later. We wanted to give a range of penalties that could include not jail time, but at least more significant penalties, maybe a driver's license, something that recognized the severity of the result of the minor infraction. And we took that to the legislature, and we had one legislator who was, look, we're not going to criminalize negligence. And so you can take your bill basically and stuff it, because we're not going to, there's no way it's getting anywhere. And that guy's still in the legislature. And, you know, he's not a fan of the sorts of things that would increase penalties for when people are killed by errant motorists. So we're kind of stuck at with the legislature that we have right now.
So that brings me to the police, because it's oftentimes the police who do not follow up with interviews or with reports or even maybe take sides. If more police were interested in these kinds of things, do you think there would be a better chance of legislation passing?
I think in general, there's been sort of a shift in the last decade, where I think in a bad case, in a fatal crash, in general, 95%+ of the time, the police, the investigating law enforcement organization, does a pretty good job of deeply, thoroughly investigating. There's enough crash reconstruction experts. There's enough. They interview people. They do most of the time. They do a pretty good job in the biggest cases. It's when it gets down to somebody's hurt. Maybe they're not maimed and killed, but they're still injured pretty badly. And it's just, oh, here, you know, there's a 3-page typical report. They don't get the witness names. All they want to do is write the ticket and then get on to the next case. So I think it's in those smaller cases where we see problems. We still have some problems in the big ones, but occasionally, but that's, you know, less often than in the smaller injury cases where we frequently don't get a good thorough report, where there's no witness names taken. You know, the person who is hit often, especially with cyclists, they're sort of embarrassed that they're even in this accident. They may have a head injury. They may be suffering. They may be dazed and confused, and they want to tell everybody they're okay. And they just want to get away from the attention that they're getting all of a sudden because they're in this crash, you know? And so they just kind of, the report gets done and off they go. And then they shake their head, you know, a day later and go, wait a minute, what in the heck happened? And sometimes they don't even get treatment right away. And then they find out, oh man, I had a concussion. I had my bell rung and I'm, you know, now I'm out of commission for a while. And we're stuck with this goofy little police report. So those two cases, there's a bigger problem with police officers not doing their job as deeply and thoroughly as I think we'd like to see. Rarely, if you look for statistics on distracted driving, and of course it's hard to prove that, but almost never is that box checked. You know, the police officer asks the driver, were you looking at your phone? No. Okay. And then there's no attempt to get the phone or unless somebody else says, oh, gee, I think that person was looking at a phone, then they might try to subpoena the phone records and check the data. First thing I send out in every case that we get is a letter to the driver with a big, I use about a 16-point font that says, a notice to preserve evidence, and we put them on notice that we're not only do we want the records for the phone, we want the phone itself, because we can often, if we get a phone, you can extract data from the phone that the person doesn't even know is in there, GPS data or speed data or other things that, you know, so we put them on notice on day one that we want that. And then if we end up in litigation 2 years later, we can A, subpoena that, or B, if they don't have it, make an argument to the judge and the jury that, you know, the reason they don't have that phone is because there is stuff on there they didn't want you to see. And so, you know, we try to set that up early on in these cases.
Well, what you're saying now brings me to the last thing I want to talk about. You have something called the Bike Law app that is downloadable through iTunes. What is it?
Well, we haven't updated it recently. It was harder to update than it was worth. It, in the old days, it was an app where you could gather data at a crash scene. And it was very complex, and it brought together like 10 different pieces and let you sit at a crash scene and take pictures and take videos and write things down and get your GPS and package it all into one package. And you hit the email to Steve button, and then it would send it to me. And it turned out to be kind of more of a hassle than people weren't really using it in that way. And so we decided to not update it. So, but I do get calls now from the crash scene from people from time to time, or emails, and say, hey, I just got hit. What should I do? And so we have a card that we've printed out 10 things you should do. And then we have people call me and we talk and we walk them through it. I had the head of one of the leading bicycle advocacy groups in the state. And she got hit. She was in the bike lane. A car turned in front of her, hit her, knocked her off the bike onto the ground, hit her head. And she called me and said, I just got hit. And, you know, I think I'm okay. Do you think I should call the ambulance? And I could tell, just because I talked with her over the years, I could tell that something was off, you know? And so we said, no, call the 911, get the police there, get the ambulance there. And they were fighting her because it was a rainy day and they didn't want to send anybody out. Well, it turns out she had a head injury that knocked her out of the game for a while, you know? But when you're sitting there, you don't even realize it. You're dazed, your head is not working right. I had another case with a guy who had a helmet camera. He got rear-ended, knocked to the ground, his head, you see his head in the video, hit the ground. He gets up, he looks around, his bike is under the car, he kind of shakes his head, he walks over, sits down for the next 30 minutes. He's talking to everybody, and he had the good fortune of being hit across the street from a hospital at a Chipotle where all the doctors were. And they all came running out. He got all these guys in their coats and their scrubs, and they're talking to him and checking him out. He has no memory, zero of that. He's seen that video 100 times, has no memory of saying, I'm fine, I'm okay, I just want to go home. And they talked him into sticking around. He got an ambulance, you know, sent him on his way. So again, I talk so much, I forget the question, but the app is out.
Well, and so
designed to help people at the scene.
So what you're suggesting is A, don't leave the scene, B, take pictures, find witnesses, write things down, you know, try to, if you're injured so badly, you can't do that. How do you get people to come forward and to support what's going on?
You know, there's that line between injured so badly that you're on a stretcher and gone before you know what's happening. If you're there for a while and you have the wherewithal, or you're riding with people, get people to take pictures. You can't have too many pictures. You can't have too much video before everything is swept up and moved, because, again, the police officer may not make measurements and record location of where the car is, where the skid marks are, where the bike ended up. In a smaller case, but we'd want to have that data. So all that video and all that scene photos are great. We need names of people that are around. We need any data from anyone who might know something. And now what we do, we look for security footage from stores. If it happened in that area, we look at Ring doorbells to see if we can find something from a doorbell camera that might have captured something. I had to file a lawsuit in Columbus on a case that happened in front of a Circle K gas station. And up in the upper left-hand corner, big screen video, you see my guy getting rear-ended by a car, and he gets knocked into the windshield and then thrown off the car into the Circle K parking lot. But in order to get that video, I usually don't file lawsuits right away. In this case, I had to file a lawsuit a week after the crash because they were going to delete the, tape over or delete the data. And so we had to file a lawsuit. So we had a vehicle to issue a subpoena to Circle K so we could get the video from them before they deleted it. So acting quickly in these cases can be important. So it's if it's any kind of a serious case, you ought to get counsel involved early too, so we can talk to witnesses before people forget things, you know, get pictures of things, go out to the scene. Sometimes the data is still there, the skid marks or places where the police might have marked, and we can see what happened and all of that stuff. The earlier we can get into it, the better off you are and the better off your claim will be. for, you know, preserving it for the future. You know, in most cases in a, where you have a claim, you get hit, 85% of the cases that I get, we settle them before we have to litigate. If you are in litigation, you're usually 2 to 3 to 4 years out. And now you're trying to remember stuff that happened, you know, that long ago. So getting in early, preserving information, getting pictures, getting all the people's names, getting statements, all of that stuff on day one helps you, you know, on day 700.
Well, Steve, this has just been really enlightening and in sort of a sad way, but a good way in terms of what people can do. Your jurisdiction is basically Ohio and Kentucky.
We do. If I get an Indiana case, I have a fellow in Indiana I work with, another attorney in Ohio, and I handle, we tag team cases in Kentucky. And then I have cases now from here to Toledo, Cleveland, Youngstown, Mansfield, Columbus, all over the state.
But wow.
I also wanted to say, and you were talking about statistics earlier, the Ohio Bicycle Federation has a website, ohiobike.org. I sit on the board. And Tricia Kovach is one of the board members, and she has the wherewithal and skill set to extract data from the state of Ohio, turn it into a map, and then post that map on the Ohio Bicycle Federation page. So if you really like to visualize what's happening for Ohio and crashes and information, you can go to the Ohio Bike website and pull down the collision data page. And there's a page for bikes and a page for pedestrians. And it has every crash that has injured or involved a pedestrian or a cyclist is on one of those pages back to like 2014, I think. And you can look at each year, you can put them all on top of each other. You can go, each crash has a little point on the map. And if you click that point, a box comes up with all the crash information from that particular crash. So it's a fantastic resource for anyone who's looking at the crashes. What we that's different is that we take every fatal crash and we get every bit of data that we can, everything. We don't just get the 3 or 4 page crash report. We get the full 50, 60 page report, the autopsy and whatever might be involved, body cam, cruiser cam. And then we look at all that before we start talking about these cases. So.
You know, let's hope nobody actually has to use this. I mean, obviously, the best case scenario for you would be to be put out of business, but
that's right. Zero.
Right. And Vision Zero is not zero.
No, so far, though, 2022 has been, I'm afraid to say it, but it's been a good year in that we've only heard of one fatality in the state, which for May 3rd is very good. Usually we have fatalities early in the year, and then May, June, July, August, September, those are sort of the bigger months when kids get out of school, when there's more riding and the weather cooperates. And then September especially is dangerous because of a lot of things, but that just tends to be a kind of a dangerous month for cycling. So be careful out there.
Right. Thank you so much for talking with me. I think people will be interested. We will post the link to the Ohio Bicycle Maps on our blog site and to Steve's website. And let's hope that you just get to ride this year and not
right.
too many cases. Thank
Put
you.
Put me
so
out
much.
Of business, please.
Exactly. Thanks so much for talking with me. You have a wonderful right. rest of your day.
You too. Thank you, Diane. Well, anytime.
My thanks to Steve Magus for joining me on the show this week. We have information on the Ohio Bike Federation, as well as a link to Steve's website on our OutspokenCyclist.com blog. My thanks also to Noah Banyan for filling us in on the Recreation Act of 2022. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time, we'll be taking a look at the Handmade Bike Show in Australia, as well as discussing the second edition of Hearts of Lions, an in-depth look into American bike racing with author Peter Nye. Please remember to check out OutspokenCyclist.com, where every episode is accompanied by photos, links, and show notes. Subscribe to our podcast on your favorite app, and please share the show with your cycling friends. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.